Good afternoon. It's always a pleasure to come to this conference, which is as interesting as the last ones. So today I'm going to talk about the flow in the deep mantle, and I will try to show you that it's really a question of plumes and slabs. And to do this, I'm going to go back and forth between the observation that we're trying to explain and laboratory experiments. So of course, lab experiments cannot reproduce a lot of the complexities of the Earth, especially, for example, phase transition. But you can isolate different physical phenomena and study them in a very controlled manner, so that you can get some scaling laws, some insights about the physics responsible for the observation that we have on Earth. So of course, this work has been done with a lot of very talented postdoc and students. I've put the list there, and a lot of my colleagues, because my expertise is more about lab experiments and physics, and so when I have to deal about the Earth, it's always more interesting to do it in collaboration. So, okay. So, first of all, very quickly, the observation that we're interested in. So when we're looking at the tomographic models, we see that the mantle seems, we have those two red hot potatoes at the bottom of the mantle. If you do a contour plot of S-wave velocity anomaly, for example, from the S-mean model, you see that there is a lot of structure in those two large low-velocity provinces. So the first question is, why do we have only two right now? So there have been also some papers pointing out that, well, maybe we have some others, hints of those large low-velocity provinces, but not as large. So the geochemistry and mineral physics is telling us that if you want to understand what you sample at the surface and what the seismic waves are telling us, there should be some chemical heterogeneity down there that you're not always sampling, and which is probably denser. And geochemistry, again, is telling us that part of this chemical heterogeneity is probably very old, several billion years old. Then the last observation is that most of the surface hotspots are localized in those two LLSVPs. So if we talk about hotspot, we all know about the very long track hotspot like Hawaii or Easter, La Réunion, and they usually start with a big trap event, a big oceanic plateau or trap on the continent, and they're followed by a volcanic track that can be 100 million years long. And from a fluid mechanics point of view, it's very easy to produce this kind of thing if you have a plume, which is usually with a big head and a small conduit. And what is interesting, if you look at those long track hotspots, is that in fact they're all on the edges of the low velocity provinces. And if you trace where were the different oceanic plateau and large igneous provinces erupted in the last 250 million years, where they're also in the vicinity of the edge of those low, large velocity provinces, except a few ones, like, for example, the one producing the Siberian Trap. Then there is also another type of hotspot on Earth, for example, the type you can find in the French Polynesia, where you have a lot of shorter tracks, shorter like 20 to 40 million years at most in length, and those shorter tracks are in clusters. So we have this cluster here, and what is interesting is that if you look at the reconstruction The Darwin Rise, which is another cluster, erupted about 100 million years ago, exactly on where the Polynesia is right now. So there seemed to be a 100 million year recurrence in this other type of volcanism. And the last thing is the more we have resolution in the tomographic models, and the better we can see hot upwellings coming in the lower mantle. And if we remember about the fluid mechanics image of a thermal plume with a large head and a thin conduit, this conduit should be at most a few hundred in the lower mantle kilometer thick. But what we're seeing now on the tomographic images is something that is much larger. So plumes happen to be fat when we can image them in the lower mantle. And there seems to be also something happening at the horizon of 1,000 to 800 kilometer depth. So to summarize, I'm going to try to understand today, do we have any idea about the origin of those mantle boxes? Why is the mantle cut into those boxes? Then if we zoom on one box, why do we have several types of upwelling and hotspots? What can create an upwelling to be really fat compared to a purely thermal one? And what could happen around 1,000 kilometer depth? Then the last question will be about time dependence of this large-scale division of the mantle. Do we have large provinces in the bottom of the mantle that are changing shapes through time? So the first one. So this is the typical experimental setup. We have a plexiglass trunk. It's a fish tank, 30 by 30 centimeter wide. And we can vary the height so that the aspect ratio vary between 2 and 5. We can have measurements about the temperature field. So using thermal liquid crystals, you can image isotherm, and you will see a lot of those. We can measure the velocity field using particle tracking features. And we can also have access to the concentration field if we have a heterogeneity in density. This time we're using fluorescent dyes. So the fluids that we've been using over the years are Newtonian, but with strongly temperature-dependent viscosity, like sugar syrup. And then lately, we've complexified the problem using polymers and even colloids to have a rheology that will go from Newtonian in the bulk, like mostly in the mantle, to brittle on the top. But today I will speak mainly about the sugar syrup. So, so we are heating from below at a constant temperature and cooling from above at a constant temperature. So the intensity of convection is given by the Rayleigh number, which is the ratio of the engine of convection, so the buoyancy, compared to the two effects that the wants to retard or even eliminate the instability, diffusion of heat and diffusion of momentum. So this Rayleigh number for the Earth, for a planet, is typically between 10 to 6, 10 to 9, and this is something that is really easy to do in the laboratory right now. So this is an image of the onset of convection. So we are heating from below here. You see first all the isotherm going up. So it's by diffusion. And then suddenly you have the burst of a plume, and the plume is rising up. So this is what is happening. In a constant viscosity fluid, you will have hot plumes and you will have cold plumes. But on Earth, we have cold plates and hot plumes, so two different scales of convection. And this is because the viscosity depends strongly on temperature. And if we're looking at a strongly temperature-dependent viscosity convection, you get for really a large viscosity ratio between cold and hot a stagnant lead, and then you have the cellular convection underneath. But there is for large Rayleigh number and intermediate viscosity ratio, there is a very interesting regime where you can have a very stable cold downwelling and then encased a number of hot upwelling. So in this case, you have two scale of convection, the one with creating the upwellings with a much shorter wavelength here than the one creating the cold downwellings. So we have scaling laws about that, both so in the lab for rigid boundaries, but also for free boundaries. And if you apply the scaling to the mantle, it's telling you that those cold downwelling cells would be about 10,000 kilometers apart. So this is the size of the Pacific. It is really a good news. But however, in each of those boxes, about 10,000 kilometers wide, you will have several of those thermal plumes. The other thing that is interesting is that in the lab, we see that the plumes that are the closest from the downwellings are lives a lot longer. So it's a very good way of explaining why the long tracks are at the edge of the slabs, for example, in the Pacific. So we've answered the first question. Those mantle boxes, in fact, they're due to the variable viscosity of the mantle and they're due to subduction. So the subduction is really cutting your mantle in pieces, in boxes. But then what about the upwellings? So for that, we need to explore what is going on with the density heterogeneities. And so here, it's an experiment with a Rayleigh number of about 10 to 7. And we have, it's accelerated, as you can see. So we are heating from below, and so the lower layer that was initially denser because of composition is suddenly getting unstable, and so you have those really big domes going up. But then they're getting cooling from the top, and then they go down, and so on. And the last thing that I want you to see is that on the top of those domes, you have upwellings, because those things, even though they might be denser, they're still hotter, so that they're heating the fluid above it, and so you can have several secondary plumes on the top of those domes. So those domes here are very fat, but we were using a more viscous lower layer using polymers. So here, it's the same type of experiment, this with a localized heat source. And the orange layer here, it's exactly the same sugar as this one here, just with a little bit salt added. So it's denser, so it gets heated, and then you've got the instability. And this time, with sugar, you have the instability that is less viscous than the ambient, so you go back to the plume, the plume shape. So this was for a buoyancy ratio of about 0.4. So the buoyancy ratio, it's really the key parameter to understand this phenomenon, is the ratio of the density of the difference in density of chemical origin, so it's going to stabilize the system, divided by the density difference of thermal origin, which wants to destabilize the system. So for a low buoyancy ratio, the thermal effect can counterbalance and overcome completely the compositional effect, and so you can have plume. But you see also that the plume was going up, and then this orange, chemically denser, finally went down again. So again, when the plume is rising, it's losing a bit of its heat to the ambient, and so the temperature is decreasing, so that at a certain level, the buoyancy of the orange material becomes denser again. And so you can have plumes that are eventually going to fail to reach the top. So if I increase this local buoyancy ratio, so again, instability, and then rising. But then in this case, you see this, that the level of neutral buoyancy is obtained much lower into the box. So in fact, for those thermochemical instabilities, we always have a behavior that is very strongly dependent on time. And we can generate really fat features even if the inside is less viscous. And this fat feature, it's because there is an inner circulation within this dome here. And on top of this hot dome, you can have one or several secondary plumes. So as you increase the buoyancy ratio, you're going, of course, to decrease the level of neutral buoyancy until the buoyancy ratio is greater than one. And then in this case, you might deform a little bit the interface, but you're just going to have a purely thermal plume with thin filaments untrained. And geochemically, it's those filaments that you're going to sample on the top of your mantle. So in thermochemical convection, the fat upwellings are due to circulation or to viscosity or both. And if you take a strongly non-Newtonian viscosity, like here, for example, you get even more fat plumes. I mean, fat plumes, if you change the viscosity, are quite easy to get. Then it's quite complicated and time-dependent, so that when we interpret the observation, there is this very big constraint of time that we have in some way to include. So if every plume that is thermochemical can reach a level of neutral buoyancy, you can understand that if this plume is reaching a boundary, like for example a phase boundary, and is a little bit delayed in its progression, then this delay through the boundary can even stop it, and then you have again the generation of a cluster of secondary plume on top of your boundary. So all those experiments, of course, are done in a fluid that doesn't have properties that depends on pressure. So of course, in the real mantle, you have pressure and depth dependence of density. You have different phases, you have thermal expansion varying, viscosity, and so on. So all this is going to modify the level of neutral buoyancy. And that's a very powerful way of stopping or changing the image of your fat plumes at some level in the mantle. And there have been a lot of numerical studies, starting with those two pioneering, Basia Gurnis and also Samuel, which showed that if you have, for example, a density difference between your plume and the ambient mantle that is depending on depth, then you're going to have you're always going to reach a level of neutral buoyancy for the chemically denser material, but you also can get very different shapes depending on the different properties. And it's a good way to have a very steep boundary, for example, between your instability and the rest of the mantle. So in fact, the fluid mechanics is really predicting that we should have the coexistence of several types of hot instability in the mantle. And one very interesting thing is that to have those, to have an effect on the morphology of a plume, you need only density differences between 0.1 and 1%, which is extremely easy to create when you think about what the mass, the mantle, could have been when it becomes solid, or also that we have the reinjection of lithosphere and crust all the time. So it's very easy to create those type of chemical heterogeneities. So then we have scaling laws for the spacing of those instabilities as well. And they showed that in the mantle, at the CMB level, you should have one instability every 2,000 to 4,000 kilometers, and within a time scale that is between 100 and 200 million years. So do we see this in the data? So first of all, I was telling you about Polynesia, this hotspots cluster. So I would claim that this is due to a large-scale thermochemical dome in the lower mantle that is stuck or is just moving up, and you have several plumes on top of it. The scaling from the lab can give us an idea, a prediction about the oscillation time between two upwelling episodes, and we get for viscosity comparable to the mantle very easily a periodicity of about 100 million years. So it explained really well Darwin rise and then Polynesia now. So if I look now at my large low velocity province, so I have already four long track instability on the edge. I have one here also. So if I pave my domain with instability, hot instabilities, and that's what fluid mechanics is telling us that should happen, well, I've got some missing here. So let's look first of all here. Well, Cecilia Cadio, Isabel Panet, and Michel Diamant have looked at the geoid decomposed in wavelet. And it's really very interesting because in this area here, where we had a hole, so there is no volcanism right now on the surface. Well, if you look at the geoid, you have this big anomaly here, quite deep. And if you do the inversion, you see that you can explain the data only if it's a heavy dome, which is descending. So we have Polynesia, we had an upwelling. Here we have a downwelling. It might be hot, but it's denser, so it's globally going down. What is interesting also is that if you reconstruct where this dome would have been 35 million years ago, then it would have been under part of Line Island, which was active 35 million years ago. So it means that 35 million years ago, my dome was up. And the other thing that is very nice is that 140 million years ago, the big Ineos province of Shatsky Rise was formed in the area. So that we have, again, a 100 million year cycle in the Pacific. Okay. So we are still missing two instabilities. So I was really interested by Anna's talk this morning because Samoa is obviously a very nice candidate. It's at the right place. It's there. So fluid mechanics is telling us that, yes, we should have something going on here, and that's exactly what the tomography is seeing. So we have one here, so we need one here. And in fact, this one, so if you look, of course, right above the CMB, you see that there is an extrema. So it's really hot there. It could create an instability. And if you look into the the tomographic model, you see something, a big dome, that is coming up, but below a 1,000 kilometer depth. So I would propose that we have an instability, but it has not reached the surface yet. It's going up. And you can do exactly the same exercise for the Atlantic. So the upwellings, I think, for the variety of upwellings, and you can explain a lot of the observation with compositional density heterogeneities that interact with thermal convection. So now about the time dependence of those large low velocity provinces. Well, if you, the big problem on Earth is the time constraint. So for example, if we look just at tomography, for example, if we look at this big transect here, we see something going up around here, and then everything is stuck in the upper mantle. And so of course, we would like to say, okay, it's rising here, and then it's doing this. Well, and in the lab, in all the experiments we've done, well, fortunately, we have also the same end result for one of the experiments, but we have all the history. And so that's the beginning. So I'm hitting my mantle from below. Okay. Then I've got the instability starting and the plume rising, and that's what I get at the end. So in fact, convection is a very time-dependent phenomena, and it's a very good way to carry fast hot material from the bottom to the top. And you can do exactly the same exercise for thermochemical convection. If you look at this guy here, it's rising, and then now there isn't anything anymore. So that I would claim that the LLSVP's area, in fact, every time you have a big plume head event, it means that you've taken material from the bottom and put it at the top. And so the area should decrease every time you have one of those big plumes. And that's probably also, if you look, for example, at CAMP, right now, most of the reconstruction below, it's not red anymore. It's on the side. Same for Louisville, if you say that it was on Tongjava, and so on. And the last thing also is that fluid mechanics is telling us, okay, cellular cold cells that are about 10,000 kilometers wide, so it's nice for the Pacific. But if I pave my Earth with this, I can have six cells. So of course, you're going to tell me there is continents. But even though there is fluid mechanics is saying that there is no reason why we should have only two, all the more that we saw that every time we have a slab coming down, it's pushing the denser material around. So it could be interesting, for example, to look at what is happening here. This red dot here is right under the position that would have had the Siberian traps when they erupted. If you do cross-section, I took here the ESMIN model, and so this is this point here. And if you do cross-section, you can very well see the subduction, so the Pacific one, but also the Tethys. And you see that in fact, so the Tethys one is quite a new one. It's the one that is, especially in the Mediterranean, it has started not a very long time ago. So, and you see that it's the slab that is cutting this Siberian anomaly to the Icelandic one. So I would propose that maybe that 200 million years ago or 300 million years ago, we had one box here, one here, but then we may have had a big one linking the Siberian trap location to Iceland on the top of our mantle. So as a conclusion, I think that there is two main messages. One is that compositional density heterogeneities can really explain a lot of the evolution and morphology and different types of plumes. But now we have to do a lot of work on understanding how you create those density heterogeneities and how they evolve with pressure, for example. And then even the larger scale of convection in the mantle due to slabs is strongly varying through time, so that the image that we see now was probably not the one of 100 million years ago. And all the models that we've seen this morning, for example, by Nicola and so on, show exactly the same thing. And at the billion-year scale, it was completely different. Thank you.